from Chicago. This is Chris Roebling, substituting for Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national political developments, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo offered up by our panel of political pundits, insiders, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, we're featuring commentary from Charles Lipson, Hugo Chaviano, John McCarron, and Dan Miller. Our program is coming to you from our home base on State Street, that great street at the new Museum of Broadcast Communications in beautiful downtown Chicago. Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the program. Our toll-free number is 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. Our email address is btb@museum.tv. Well, we've got a lot to talk about this week in politics and national developments and indeed in international developments. Of course, the nation gripped this morning by the realization that two New York City police were gunned down assassination style just in the last 24 hours, apparently in connection with demonstrations that have been held protesting the non-charging of police who themselves had caused the deaths of other individuals. We're going to get to that conversation, but we're starting off with a conversation about Cuba and the significance of President Obama's announcement of his new opening to Cuba. Hugo Chaviano is an attorney here in Chicago, and you are a former Secretary General of the Inter-American Bar Association. In 5 years, will the regime in Cuba be significantly different from what we've encountered over the last 60 years?
Well, that's, I wish I had a crystal ball. I think it's going to be tough to foresee. You know, I think that definitely changes will have to happen as a result of this opening. I think that with the influx of business, I think with the lifting of travel restrictions, there's going to be more engagement that should impact.
Dan Miller, will we see a different Cuba in 5 years because of President Obama's opening?
No, we won't, Chris. What President Obama did is basically insignificant insofar as any fundamental change occurring in Cuba. When Raul and Fidel die, they'll be succeeded by a coterie of generals who will persist in the same policies, the same repression, the same restrictions on the economy. And no, there won't be any change 5 years from now.
John McCarron, what Cuba will we find in 5 years?
Oh, I think there'll slowly be some changes inevitably. If there's going to be more tourism, if there's going to be more diplomatic contact, I think there'll be some gradual changes. But it's going to be a slow step-by-step process. It's not going to happen overnight.
Charles Lipson, professor at University of Chicago with a lot of background in international relations. A different Cuba in 5 years?
The first thing to say is that we don't know why regimes change, and we have no really good way of predicting it. Second thing is I doubt that this opening up will have much impact. What will have an impact is that their major backers, Russia and Venezuela, are facing dramatic financial crunch because of the economic pinch of lower oil prices. So I think there'll be a lot of pressure, and there'll be pressure when the brothers die off. I think the question is whether they try to go the sort of Putin way or the military way like in Egypt, or whether they try to open up a little bit their economy like China has.
I want to ask all four of you if you see any such anticipation in President Obama's announcement. I mean, do we relate the announcement that we saw this week by the president to a prior stated American strategy or policy or identified goals or tactics to achieve those strategic aims?
Well, I think that what's driving the president's agenda right now is 50 years plus of a policy that has not really brought about the changes that all of us, I think, have hoped for in terms of, either regime change, opening up of, democracy and so forth. And I think the president is trying to get something started.
But he's not going to get anything started with tourism. The Cubans have no money. They're not allowed to have money. Baseball players go abroad and play a game. They get played well. They come back, and they have to turn the money over to the government. Then they're handed some phony kind of script that can only be spent in certain kinds of stores, just the way the Chinese did in their friendship stores for 50 years. Diplomatic, John, no embassy is going to be built. No ambassador is going to be named down in Cuba for certainly the next couple of years under a Republican House and Senate. I just don't see any reason for any change. John?
If you're telling me that the Republican Senate and House are obstructionist, I guess I agree with you, Dan. They sure are. I mean, I see a lot of revisionism going on. There's a column by Peggy Noonan today, I think one of your favorite Republican columnists in the Wall Street Journal, saying that before Castro, Cuba was a near paradise, you know. So, yeah, it was also an illiterate paradise.
That is not true, just by the way. Cuba's a little bit of a hobby of mine, and I have to say, I'm still wondering if I missed the president's policy speech on Cuba 4 years ago that would have laid out a sensitivity for these issues of bringing freedom and democracy
I would say a couple of things on that. And the first is, it's kind of surprising in a way that he didn't do this much earlier, given that he got almost nothing in return for this. I mean, there's been a lot of criticism that's, I would say, is kind of partisan, but he didn't really get very much in return. He could have done this almost any time if he was going to do that. But on strategy, Chris, I think the key thing is that there's almost no strategy guiding our policy toward anything. That is, we had a strategy when the president began his term in office. That strategy essentially didn't work. It was an open hand toward our enemies, hoping that they would respond in kind. You see the tail end of that, really, with the policy toward Cuba. How has that worked out with Russia, with Iran, blah, blah, blah? It hasn't worked out. The point is, he then did not change the policy. And it's all ad hoc now. There's no policy toward anybody.
Charles and Dan yearn for the days of weapons of mass destruction and yellow cake coming from Africa. Empire. I know they miss it,
John,
and they're hoping they'll get it back in 2 years.
It's a season for cake, John.
Did you see the president's speech describing his Cuba policy, say, 3 or 4 years ago down at the Miami Chamber of Commerce? Did he fly down there? Did we miss that, or did you see it?
Why do I think that if the president said no, if he said the other day, we're going to take a harder line and increase the sanctions, that you guys would be in here wringing your hands saying, oh, no, that's the wrong way to go.
Let the record show I would not
say that his policy was wrong. By the way, I did not say that this was the wrong policy. What I said, I don't think he got very much in return for it, and I don't see how this policy toward Cuba fits into a larger strategy. If you see a strategy there, I'd like to know what
Hugo,
it is.
Let's ask Hugo.
But I wanted to address what Dan was talking about in terms of engagement and the people in Cuba. You know, one of the things that I found out and learned is that really in Cuba, did not miss anything in terms of, the embargo wasn't having any effect in terms of the people that you...
It's Hugo Chaviano, and we're going to get back to your point right after the break. It's Beyond the Beltway. Chris Roebling sitting in for Bruce Dumont. Stay with us.
Are you headed to Los Angeles? Looking for the ideal place for you and your family to relax and enjoy yourselves? A place that combines a Four Diamond Hotel experience with a convenient location? It's the Hilton Los Angeles Universal City, just steps away from Universal Studios Hollywood, CityWalk, and NBC Studios. Just a short ride to the Hollywood Walk of Fame, TCL Chinese Theater, Warner Brothers, and other popular attractions. Enjoy spacious rooms offering breathtaking views and a world-class Las Vegas-style seafood and prime rib buffet every weekend and holidays. Share family fun and enjoy the oasis of the palm tree-lined pool and whirlpool. Relax in your own private poolside cabana with a cocktail or snack at your fingertips. Book your reservation today at HiltonUniversal.com or call 1-800-774-1500. The Hilton, Los Angeles, Universal City at HiltonUniversal.com. They let you be the star in Hollywood.
Season's greetings, everybody. It's Chris Roebling sitting in for Bruce Dumont. We've got an illustrious panel. Let's introduce ourselves. We're going to start with our newest member of the panel, Hugo
Chaviano.
I don't want to get it wrong. Chaviano. Hugo Chaviano, give us a couple of words about yourself.
Yeah, I'm a partner here in Chicago at a law firm, and I'm past president of the Hispanic National Bar Association and past secretary general of the Inter-American Bar Association.
And native Cuban?
Native Cuban. Left Cuba by myself when I was 13 years old. Supposed not to see my parents again, that we were reunited 40 years later, however, and here I am.
Terrific. We're glad you're joining us tonight. Dan Miller, a word about yourself.
Dan Miller, I'm a former journalist here in Chicago, Daily News, the Chicago Sun-Times, Crane Chicago Business, and I'm a policy advisor at the Heartland Institute, a 25-year-old libertarian-oriented think tank based in Chicago.
We'll get back to Dan in a second. Charles Lipson.
I teach international politics at the University of Chicago. I'm originally from Mississippi, and I've been writing a monthly column for the Tribune, although it really can't erase the damage done by McCarran over there.
All right, John McCarran, you better tell us who you are.
Yeah, John McCarran. I also write a monthly column op-ed for the Chicago Tribune, where once upon a time I was urban affairs editor and then financial editor. And my final 7 years there on the editorial board, where I was a voice of centrist reason on an otherwise Republican group. So I'm no stranger to being surrounded by hostile folks.
I have no doubt you believe every word of that very sincerely. All right, Dan Miller, back to you. Big news today is that you are going to be sitting in for Bruce Dumont as he takes his winter sojourn, and you're going to be doing the TV version.
Right. Bruce has bifurcated beyond the Beltway. He will be doing the radio program from California, where he visits his family for two warm and sunny months. I will be doing the TV version here in Chicago, which will run at midnight on WICC Channel 20, plus on cable Comcast Cable 100, and it'll run several times throughout the week. It also streams live on Beyond the Beltway's website, and it will be on that's about it, I guess.
Yeah. I don't know about you guys, but when I do this program, for the next 10 days, people will walk up to me and say, oh, I saw you last night on TV. Nice. Because they were watching, they had Comcast 100 on. Mm-hmm. It's an amazing operation Comcast has going. Hugo, you were making a point before the break, and we want to pick up with that.
Just very quickly, with respect to a point raised by Dan, I think that, you know, part of the important thing here in terms of the Cuban people right now is for them to have exposure to the outside. And I think it's a positive, any kind of lifting of travel restrictions that allow more people to get in there, because the Cuban people as a whole really have no access to information from the outside per se, other than what the government feeds them. So I think that that's a positive. The second thing, very quickly, is with respect to the embargo and the fact that the goals that the embargo was meant to accomplish, you know, were not reached, and the ones, in my opinion, that it's really suffering have been the people of Cuba and not the aparatique.
But I'm going to challenge you on that. I believe that the embargo has worked. The embargo has been a smashing success, and the embargo should continue for that reason within the context of a fully elaborated and articulated international strategy. Now, here's what I mean. The embargo has succeeded because we are within, it's because of the point that Charles made earlier about the collapse of global oil prices and the spot price for oil actually hovering between sort of $45 and $65 per barrel. That has constricted not only ability of Russia, which is very significantly out of the Cuba business, but Venezuela, which has significantly gotten into the Cuba support business over the last decade. It has constricted their ability to maintain their subsidies for the terror and the oppression of the Castro regime, which is an institutionalized kleptocracy. Okay. If we had some kind of strategy going to work down there, I believe that we would be – the government is so weak, it's so fragile, that we could see a peaceful resolution.
What's your evidence that it's fragile?
Yeah.
I can see why it's under a lot of economic pressure. Let me push back at this. I mean, I can see both sides. The one side, which is essentially, we've tried it for 50 years, it hadn't worked. And the other side is they're under a lot of pressure. But let me push you on that. Where's the sign they're fragile?
When the Soviet Union pulled out, the allocations of resources to average Cubans collapsed until Venezuela stepped in. When Venezuela stepped in, they raised the allocation. So retirees in Cuba, you go to Parque Central in Havana Vieja, and you talk to the retirees who are sitting there, and they get this much rice and they get this much meat per month. And if they run out before the end of the month, that's it. And the only reason, you know, there, when I was there and I was interviewing retirees, at on pain of interrogation, if not beating, they would say to me, there's only one thing I would say to Fidel. I'm hungry.
Well, I will tell you that Castro brothers have proven very resilient to be able to withstand economic sanctions. After the Cuban, the Russian subsidies died, then we, Cuba went through this special period where people were practically starving, and they were able to withstand that. I think that in spite of what's happening with Venezuela, there is a China that can step in, and they have been, you know, poking their nose in Latin America and wanting to have more influence. I can see Russia being interested in again in Cuba just to spite the U.S., given now the current sanctions on the other side. So I don't think that neither the Castro regime is about to fall, and I think that we need to do something to start getting in there to see if we bring about
Hugo, this
change.
Is not going to help the demise of the Castro administration. This little tiny lifting of certain parts of the embargo, all the benefits will go to the regime. None of the benefits will go to the people. There is nothing here that is going to help the individual Cubans. So, if anything, this will perpetuate the Castro
regime. Well, I mean, I would agree about the point of travel.
What? How does that help?
Hugo, well, I mean, I think
there's
that,
no money in Cuba for Cubans. They're not allowed to have dollars.
I well understand. The best job in Cuba is to be a doorman at an international hotel to get tips and dollars.
If you spend those dollars, you'll be arrested. And
right.
If you even show those dollars too much, you'll be turned in by your neighbors.
That is right.
The whole country is one repressive foot on your neck.
Yeah, the joke is that He bragged to me that he was a doorman, but it turns out he's only a neurosurgeon.
That is absolutely the case. I don't know. John, I mean, how do you think Obama's policy will effectuate change on the ground for the average Cuban?
Well, I think it's a process of engagement, and it's little by little. It would be nice if our new Republican Congress would lift the embargo so we could really flood the country with dollars and iPhones and
there's
whatnot.
There's no money to buy them, John. You could flood the place with iPhones, but there's no money for the Cuban consumer to buy them.
That's not the issue to me. The issue is not – well, it's important that they can't buy them, but I think that the problem is that the regime will do everything it can to hold on, and we just don't know whether the opening will give them more resources to keep their grip or decentralized power. Everybody's talked about this guy, Alan Gross, who was in prison.
Right.
Do you know why he was in prison? He was trying to help the Jewish community there get internet access.
Yeah.
That's why he was imprisoned. He was trying to help people get communication. I think that the biggest deal that could happen there would actually be the opening up of communications. And I don't understand why we're not broadcasting radio-free.
When I was in Cuba, which is now 15 years ago, and I've got to get back, but the last time I was in Cuba, everybody was sitting around watching WGN television off the satellite.
Well,
they were watching.
I think it's watching the Cubs that's completely disintegrated their sense of spirit, their sense that they could actually accomplish something.
There's no question that the teams that were mentioned by Hemingway in Old Man and the Sea, which includes, I think, the Cubs and the Sox, the White Sox, have a special hold on the Cuban imagination. I mean, there are real Yankees fans there. There are real Cub fans. But
there is no internet access there. None. Zero.
It is zero. I well remember going to Capitolio in central Havana. There was literally a room smaller than this studio with about six computers, and that was the internet access.
And compare that with China. China, a gargantuan country, is also able to restrict internet access to its people, who are far more advanced than the Cubans when it comes to being technologically savvy. This is not going to help anybody down.
China has rural democratic practices. I mean, there are actual elections in the backwaters of China. I mean, when you talk about the Cuban regime, you're talking about Brezhnev-era repression. There are no elections there.
I think that we all agree that this is not at all, you know, the best kind of solution for the Cuban situation. From my standpoint, I believe, like John mentions, that at least it's a step, it's doing something where nothing has been done. And I think that that in itself, you know, is very important.
Can I ask you a question?
Real quick.
Could we have gotten more in the deal?
I think that the dealings with the Castro brothers have always been, you know, one way, my way. I think that this deal, in some respects, is kind of, kind of engaging them and trying to just kind of let's get there and try to see what happens.
That is Hugo Chaviano with Sanchez, Daniels, and Hoffman joining us on Beyond the Beltway. I am Chris Roebling sitting in for Bruce Dumont. We're sending you holiday greetings from Chicago, and we hope you'll stick with us. We'll be back after these words.
This is Larry King at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Tonight we've got a special guest for you to meet. What do you like to do as a kid?
I like to play baseball. I like to watch television.
What was your favorite sports team?
Sports team growing up was the St. Louis Cardinals.
What was your favorite vacation?
I think the vacation we went to New York City to the World's Fair. See Yankee Stadium.
Who was your childhood hero?
Childhood hero, probably Hopalong Cassidy.
What was your biggest fear growing up?
The biggest fear probably was that I would irritate my father.
What's the silliest thing you've ever done?
Irritated my father.
Give the gift of Larry King this holiday season. Order your gift certificate now at museum.tv. That's museum.tv.
From Chicago, this is Chris Roebling. Season's greetings. Welcome back to Beyond the Beltway. We're having a conversation about Cuba and its impact both in Cuba, the president's new opening to Cuba, and its impact in Cuba. We want to get eventually to its impact back here in the United States, apart from around the world. And let's talk about that. In the break, we were getting to the question of succession, what has frequently been referred to as the biological solution, that the Castro brothers can't live forever. Eventually, they'll shuffle off this mortal coil, and then some kind of change will take place. Hugo, can you walk us through your view?
Yeah, my view is that whatever changes will happen in Cuba in terms of succession and of power is going to be an internal solution. It's not going to come from the outside, given the fact that there is no interest on the part of a power like the United States to militarily intervene. I think that the whole family tree of the Castro brothers, both Fidel's and Raul, is almost something tantamount to state secret within Cuba, because you really don't hear much about them. But behind the facade, people like Raul Castro's oldest son, Alejandro Castro Espín, he has now is figuring as kind of like a right-hand person for his father, and they, in fact, control a lot of the business enterprise that takes place in Cuba, because really the armed forces in Cuba control and get the revenue of a lot of the tourism, a lot of the export of tobacco, rum, and all these goods that Cuba sends to the outside. So it's a major enterprise, and if you look at the profile of a lot of the generals within the inner circle of the Cuban regime, they're multimillionaires.
Of course. So, Swiss bank accounts, Bentleys, Mercedes,
exactly.
The whole shot.
And they're not blocked off from connections with Europe. Right. I mean, that's no, where the trade is going.
Or Canada. Yeah. No. Yeah.
Canada. I mean, it's just the U.S., really.
Charles, that's Hugo Chaviano, and he is a newcomer to the program, and we welcome you from Sanchez Daniels and Hoffman, LLP here in Chicago. Charles Lipson, former chairman of the Political Science Department at the University of Chicago, let me ask you this question. You've written about the domestic political sources of foreign policy.
Right.
What are the domestic political sources of, say, post-Castro power allocation in Cuba?
The thing that I'm emphasizing in my current work is that regimes, the basic way that power is controlled, that they will fight tenaciously to keep control. And that's exactly what's happened in North Korea. That's what's happening in Iran. And that's what will happen in Cuba. That doesn't mean that they'll always succeed. The Shah and that regime tried to keep power. So did Batista in Cuba, right? But I think that they will fight tenaciously. And one of the effects of opening up, as Hugo is saying, is that there will have more, there'll be two effects, and it's hard to know how they play out. One is that the regime will have more resources to buy off potential opponents, and the other is that there could be a rising set of demands on the regime, which the regime will find it hard to meet. That's what happened, actually, in Iran. That's what that it was a developing country. This has been what's and the demands overwhelmed the Shah. That's what's been so striking in China, that they've been able to do 30 years of development but still not overwhelm a repressive regime.
John McCarron, do you think that rising expectations after an opening to the United States might actually spell weakness for the Cuban regime?
I think eventually, as families get reconnected, as tourism increases, and despite the fact they don't have money to buy iPhones, so I stand corrected on that one, as there's more and more yearning for the world that they see that has developed in Miami and points north, I think inevitably there'll be a groundswell, at the beginning, for something different, for a better life.
John, you're absolutely right. And the way to accelerate that is to lift the embargo completely, not this little penny-ante stuff and say you can buy $100 worth of tobacco. Do you know what a box of cigars costs? $450 at retail. $100 of tobacco is what these tourists
from your lips, from your lips, stand to Marco Rubio's ears.
No, I hope they do it. I hope they do too. That is the way to do it. That's the way to open, Charles. The idea, unleash the rising tide of expectations. Give those people something really to work for. Let them be paid in dollars. Let them keep their money. Let them live their lives. But Obama, being the great negotiator he is, blew it. We got nothing out of this thing.
What should he have gotten at this first stage, Dan? What would you know, Charles, I'm sorry, John, a few minutes ago raised this thing about, you know, what would have satisfied you guys? Okay, so fair enough. What would have satisfied you in this week's announcement?
To let people be paid by U.S. companies, let Cubans be paid by U.S. companies for work done in Cuba.
Okay, and who wants to run through for the listeners who don't know how Cuba operates, why this is not the case? Should we just say if you're a big Canadian real estate developer, you're going to put a resort down in Cuba, you pay the regime.
Right.
And for a busboy, you're paying him $36,000 a year. For a doorman, $48,000. For somebody else, you know, $75,000. And those people get between $75 a month and or $125.
What you have to point out, Chris, is that the government then takes the $75,000 and says, we'll hire the labor. So then they take John McCarron here and pays him 40 cents or $40 a month to do the work. The other $75,000 stays in the
regime's
hands.
This is common
hands.
Among repressive regimes.
Sure.
This is what happened in Myanmar, Burma, when they had a human rights disaster. We send in all this foodstuffs and everything. The regime immediately grabs it, and then their people, they distribute it to their key generals. Those people sell it. And, in effect, either the food ends up in the hands of the top people or the money ends up in the hands of the top people. It's a real problem. But in China, you can pay people. It's just that the regime has maintained its hold. So what we now know is that opening up economically does not lead inexorably to opening up politically. It may, but it may not.
Hugo, what would lead to political opening?
Well, I think that short of making a decision, which the United States, you know, many years back after the missile crisis, you know, signed a non-aggression pact with Russia with respect to Cuba, and, you know, the military option was off the table, is by, you know, engaging them commercially. That's my view, that economic engagement will lead to then the political evolution by necessity.
I couldn't agree with you more, Hugo. That's why it's so important to allow business activities between Americans and Cubans, not between Americans and the government. What Obama did was reinforce the whole idea. No, it's the government we have
right.
to deal with.
What the president did was take a first step, in my opinion.
Oh, okay. Man. All right. So let's ask about that first step here on these shores. Obviously, some of the most trenchant criticism came from folks with personal ties. So you have Democrat Senator Bob Menendez denouncing President Obama.
Menendez, a Cuban.
A Cuban-American. And, yep. and,
New
and,
Jersey.
And Republican U.S. Senator from Florida, Marco Rubio. And then there are a lot of, I believe, House Republican members with Cuban background. I'm not sure that there are House Democrat members with Cuban background. But will this have any electoral impact, John McCarron, say, in the 2016 presidential races, where Florida is always a vitally important state?
I thought that the president was writing off Florida in 2016. Perhaps, I mean, he's in a position personally where he doesn't have to worry about it anymore. But if I'm Hillary Clinton and I'm thinking it's still a swing state, I probably kind of winced when I heard the news, although I haven't heard her react to what's been said.
The last polls that I was just reading within the last 24 hours is that the majority of Cuban Americans are supportive of the president's action. So if that impacts, you know,
wasn't
Florida.
There also a poll just of Floridian Cubans, Cuban Americans?
That's my understanding.
And that will increase over time as
exactly.
the older generation
yeah.
dies off. You know, I think one of the things that you see here is the division within the Republican Party between the kind of trader side. There's the let's trade more, we're economically oriented, and the more kind of anti-communist side of the party. It's not exactly a Wall Street, Main Street division. It's the Adam Smith side versus the sort of more neoconservative side, aside from the...
Well, and so this is represented by Rand Paul and Marco Rubio
exactly.
disagreeing. And Rand
but
Paul...
No, I think they're...
But that's a principled disagreement, I think, really.
Paul and Rubio are pretty close on their assessment of what happened. I think they're both opposed to it.
No. Rand Paul is supportive of the president's initiative.
He supported the president, but he didn't think it went far enough, much like Dan Miller.
Okay. Yeah, it's the econ group versus the sort of anti-communist and hard against dictators groups within the Republican parties. Those are a real division. I think you can see it. I think that the commercial side probably won't gain the upper hand, but they'll work in tandem with the Obama administration.
So do we end up seeing any other state? I mean, maybe Florida, maybe not, based on the poll results that you mentioned. But might there be another state in which there are enough Cubans to affect the outcome, do we think?
No. I think Florida is the only state.
But I think it'll be. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, that plays in that. But like I think I said was being mentioned before, you will see right now that in the middle of this debate, which is my generation, not my parents, is like already, you know, a receptiveness towards what the president is trying to do.
All right. We have been talking about Cuba both internationally and nationally. We've got some time for other developments on the national scene. We'll take those up after this coming break. I'm Chris Roebling sitting in for Bruce Dumont. The program, of course, is Beyond the Beltway. We're glad you're with us, and we hope you stay. Back in a few.
Everyone loves vacationing in Florida. So why not experience it as it was meant to be? Where turquoise Gulf waters meet tranquil island beaches. Feel the powder-soft sand between your toes. revel in a glorious island sunset. Shop the boutiques of a seaside village. Ride horseback along tranquil waters. This is Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Real, authentic Florida, where you can discover an intimate downtown and sip cappuccino at a sidewalk cafe. Catch fresh fish for dinner. Hey, even tour a working winery. Just minutes from all the rest Florida has to offer. Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Plan your visit online at BradentonGulfIslands.com. That's BradentonGulfIslands.com.
Sitting in for Bruce Dumont. Welcome back to the program, everybody. It's Beyond the Beltway. Great conversation this evening with Charles Lipson, Dan Miller, John McCarron, and Hugo Chaviano, who has joined the program for the first time this evening. But let's turn to this awful news over the weekend, coming from New York City, where an individual said on social media that he was going to pay back the police for what he considered to be injustices done to other Americans, got himself up to New York City, and execution-style murdered two of New York's finest. I think New York, it is safe to say that New York is reeling, and New York has faced a lot, and this, I think, has touched a real nerve there. Is this a consequence of, say, the Al Sharptons of the world saying, no justice, no peace? John McCarron?
No, I don't think so. I hope people don't take this away. I mean, there's a lot of crazy people running around there with guns, and this is one of them. And I mean, my most fervent hope is that this doesn't delegitimize the arguments being made like people, and I include Al Sharpton in that group, although I'm no great fan, about the difficulty of police and African-American males, particularly, especially traffic stops and whatnot, because we all, you know, have middle-class black friends, and they all say the same thing, that they get stopped all the time, and they have to talk to their kids tonight about this issue. So I hope this one outlying incident doesn't poison that debate.
Okay. Charles Lipson, demonstrators in New York just not even a week ago. What do we want? Dead cops. When do we want them now?
Well, I think that's the most extreme end of it. I partly agree and partly disagree with John McCarron. I think that there are legitimate disputes about how police in certain locales and elsewhere around the country treat minorities. However, I think that the level of vitriol that's been waged at the police, particularly over the Ferguson incident, which looked to be quite uncertain what happened, and to the extent that there was a balance, it was against the young man who was killed and in favor of the police. Did you see the police all turn their backs on the mayor?
I have seen that video. Mayor Bill de Blasio.
It is chilling. Yeah. It is chilling. And they had already...
I didn't see that. What happened?
Mayor Bill de Blasio and some of his advisors and supporters had to walk through kind of an open room.
Accordion.
It was filled with New York policemen who were protecting him. And when he entered the room, they all turned their backs on the mayor.
So he walked through a line, an opening, but with police not facing him, but insulting him by turning their backs. They had already asked him not to attend the deaths. I think there's a question as to whether he would be able to attend the funerals of these two guys.
I would advise him against going. Hugo Chaviano, as a law enforcement, as an attorney and a officer of the court, you've heard people say that there is no peace without justice. They don't like the justice they've seen. Is there any tie between those kinds of demonstrations and how this individual set up what he was going to do today?
Well, I obviously, I think, number one, it's tragic. I think, number two, black leaders whose their community looks to should really take that very responsibly and not inflamed, passions. I think that the Ferguson situation was one set of facts. I think there's a thing in New York, not the policeman killing, but the situation with the individual who got choked to death. I think they're two complete different fact situations, and they have to be looked,
Now, but Sharpton and the others have just rev this thing up.
But have we heard from them?
We heard a few extremists talking about abortion, and an abortion doctor is killed. The entire mass media linked all anti-abortion protests to
all,
that killing.
All anti-abortion.
That was wrong.
Right.
But we shouldn't link all people who are against police brutality to this. But I must say that people like Sharpton, they have made a living as being race hucksters.
Well, I want to say, Dan Miller, you used to edit something called City and State.
Mm-hmm.
You were very involved in municipal government. Mayor de Blasio made a point of going out and saying he had told his son to be concerned about New York policemen.
He's mixed race, yeah.
His son is mixed race. I mean, was that mayor in that case bringing reconciliation?
No, I think he was trying to relate to the minority community in New York to say, I understand what you're doing. Without that kind of recognition by the chief executive of the city, you're just asking for even more trouble. What, Chris, in your initial question, if you are saying that the inflammatory rhetoric of the people like Al Sharpton, did that encourage the violence? Yes, it did. Is it actionable in some legal sense? No, of course not. They're entitled to do that. The people who did the violence are responsible.
It's Dan Miller, joined this evening by Charles Lipson, John McCarron, Hugo Chaviano. Great conversation. This is Beyond the Beltway. I'm Chris Roebling, in for Bruce Dumont, back in a few.
This is Larry King at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Tonight we've got a special guest for you to meet. What do you like to do as a kid?
I like to play baseball. I like to watch television.
What was your favorite sports team?
Sports team growing up was the St. Louis Cardinals.
What was your favorite vacation?
I think the vacation we went to New York City to the World's Fair. See Yankee Stadium.
Who was your childhood hero?
Childhood hero, probably Hopalong Cassidy.
What was your biggest fear growing up?
My biggest fear probably was that I would irritate my father.
What's the silliest thing you've ever done?
Irritated my father.
Give the gift of Larry King this holiday season. Order your gift certificate now.
Live from Chicago, it's Chris Roebling sitting in for Bruce Dumont with Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasion injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our illustrious panel. This hour, John McCarron, longtime writer for the Chicago Tribune, now a professor at DePaul University, Dan Miller, longtime editor at a number of publications here in Chicago, and now a Chicago innovation expert and soon-to-be replacement TV host for Beyond the Beltway.
While Bruce is in California visiting family.
Sunny Southern California, that's right. And we've got Charles Lipson, former chairman and current professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Chicago. Great to have you here, Charles, as well. Joining us on the phone this hour, we're happy to welcome Mark Flessner, a partner at Holland & Knight, a former federal prosecutor and someone who has spent a good deal of time on the issues of cyber safety, cybersecurity, and indeed cyber terrorism. Thank you, Attorney Flessner, for making time to join us on the program this evening.
You are welcome. I'm pleased to be here.
Well, of course, this part of the program, having discussed Cuba and events in New York City in the first hour, this part of the program is going to be devoted to an explication of the actual events and the significance of the Sony hack, which our president, Barack Obama, has said involves the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, also known as North Korea. I want to turn to Mark Flessner to get us started off on the hacking element of this story. Do we think, Mr. Flessner, do we think that this was something North Korea could have done on its own?
Well, I have no idea. North Korea's capabilities are, I think, not very well known because it's such a sequestered country. I assume the CIA or the DIA or some of the intelligence agencies know what their capabilities are. Obviously, the average layperson in the United States can opine about this as much as they want, but they're never going to get the kind of intelligence information, need to know what happened. The FBI is saying that
Mark,
this is
they have leaked information that the hackers are actually North Koreans who are based in China. Do you know anything about that?
No, I mean, I know the FBI is speculating. It's been rumored in the press that this is a North Korean based security breach. But I mean, again, the security agencies tell the public what they want the public to know, not necessarily what the truth is,
nor what they know.
That may well be too.
right. Nor what they know. But some element of North Korea, we understand, maybe other elements. But Mr. Flessner, what is your immediate reaction upon hearing perhaps 8-9 days ago that Sony had been hacked in this way?
Well, my immediate reaction was shame on Sony. Sony is a very sophisticated company, and presumably they have cybersecurity in place, and whoever was in charge of their cybersecurity failed. It's more of a failure of the company than it is anything else.
Aren't you blaming the victim for the problem? How Mark, this is Dan Miller. How, in what sense is Sony culpable?
Well, we live in a world of that we have to all have cybersecurity. Every company, every law firm, every medical office, everybody has to protect their data information, their online information, because we live in a world of where these attacks come all the time. This is not something new, and it would be naive for us to sit here and think that Sony didn't realize that they, as well as any company in the world, could be the victim of cybersecurity. I mean, we hear this every day in the media. So, I mean, you say we're blaming the victim, maybe, but it's realistically, they're the ones that should have prevented this from allowing themselves to be hacked.
Well, I want to get back to that in a second, but John McCarron has got a question for you, Mr. Flessner.
Sure. Yeah, Mark, I was curious whether you thought this was something that a sophisticated party could do strictly from the outside using invasive software, or was there an insider here, a Snowden or a you know, Julian Assange type of person who walked out with a disc or a thumb drive or something like that.
Well, I mean, again, I know what you know, which is in the media, there's been no reports of any kind of insider participating in that. This is the kind of thing, we're speculating on limited information, but this is the kind of thing that could be accessed from the outside. I mean, these cyber attacks can come, you know, at all angles at all times. So it's certainly not fantasy to think that they were able to infiltrate the Sony system from the outside.
Charles Lipson.
I think there are a couple of things to bring up here. One is that Sony is a Japanese corporation, and the North Koreans have spent a lot of time trying to penetrate into Japan. They have a lot of agents there and the rest, and there's quite a possibility that they had somebody inside. The people I've talked with in cybersecurity and web development have told me that the amount of information that was downloaded goes well beyond what individual or even a small group of hackers could do. This needed state support. Sony was apparently aware that there were attempts to penetrate them, but the information I have is that probably on the order of 95% of American corporations would have been penetrated by these kinds of attacks. So it wasn't that they had that their password was 12345. I mean, they had taken obviously not enough effort, and I gather this was not an extremely sophisticated attack. This wasn't like Stuxnet. But this is very disturbing, partly because Sony caved and partly because it was accompanied with terroristic threats, and finally because of the impact that it has on free speech in this country, which I think we'll get to after we get to
Wait a minute. Let me just go back to something that – this is Dan Miller, Mark, or for listeners. You said that it's unlikely, I think, if I'm extrapolating what you said, that this could have been done inside North Korea because of their limited technology. These people the hackers are stationed outside. Are you suggesting that there are other players other than North Korea who aided and abetted, not just offering aid and comfort, but actually were pushing the buttons and making it happen?
What I understand, this is Charles Lipson, what I understand is that their access to the web is so weak that essentially everything goes through China, and that the people that China, for example, has its own hacking group that's a part of the PLA, the People's Liberation Army. The North Koreans have that, and they are stationed in China.
And that was Charles Lipson. We're speaking with Mark Flessner tonight, Dan Miller, John McCarron. This portion of Beyond the Beltway is focusing on the Sony hack. We're going to want to hear from you. We'll give you our phone number after this break. We send our season's greetings. It's Chris Roebling in for Bruce Dumont. Please stay with us.
Are you headed to Los Angeles? Looking for the ideal place for you and your family to relax and enjoy yourselves? A place that combines a Four Diamond Hotel experience with a convenient location? It's the Hilton Los Angeles Universal City, just steps away from Universal Studios Hollywood, CityWalk, and NBC Studios. Just a short ride to the Hollywood Walk of Fame, TCL Chinese Theater, Warner Brothers, and other popular attractions. Enjoy spacious rooms offering breathtaking views and a world-class Las Vegas-style seafood and prime rib buffet every weekend and holidays. Share family fun and enjoy the oasis of the palm tree-lined pool and whirlpool. Relax in your own private poolside cabana with a cocktail or snack at your fingertips. Book your reservation today at HiltonUniversal.com or call 1-800-774-1500. The Hilton Los Angeles Universal City at HiltonUniversal.com. They let you be the star in Hollywood.
Good evening. This is Chris Roebling on Beyond the Beltway. And thanks for joining us. Also on the program this evening, Dan Miller, John McCarron, Charles Lipson. Joining us by telephone is Mark Flessner, a partner at Holland & Knight. and a former federal prosecutor. Our phone number is 1-800-723-8289. That is 1-800-723-8289. Our email address is btb@museum.tv. btb@museum.tv if you want to talk about the Sony hack, or if you still want to talk about the opening to Cuba, please give us a call. We'd love to hear from you a little bit later on in the program. Mr. Flessner, you are there. You can hear us?
Yes, I can. Thank
Terrific.
You.
Thank you. So can you help the listeners understand what steps would be taken by your colleagues, the federal investigative team, presumably multi-agency, out in Los Angeles, now that this penetration of Sony is well understood to have happened? What are the steps the L.A. field office, so to speak, would be taking relative to this penetration of Sony?
Well, I assume the FBI and other intelligence agencies are trying to pinpoint the exact source of the penetration or penetrations, if there were more than one. There probably was, actually. And once they're able to identify the sources, that information is going to go up through the halls in justice and then presumably reported to the White House, and the White House is going to take some action, apparently, from what the president has reported, what they're calling a proportional response. I mean, I don't get me wrong, I think this is a very serious thing. I think it's a serious thing for many of the reasons that you've all identified, that it inhibits free speech, the First Amendment, that it threatens our industries in the United States. But it's also a reality that all companies know that cybersecurity is a huge issue. I mean, it's the new way of conducting war, isn't it? It's a new way of invading.
Well, we have you for this segment, so I'm going to take the initiative and ask you about this question we've seen batted around in national conversations about this event, which mm-hmm. is, what is a cyber act of war?
Well, I don't think this was it. I think this was simply a data security breach. And, it's incumbent upon the private company to protect their own data and their own private information.
And I want to ask you a question on that. I want to challenge you on that because it doesn't ring true to me. The United States federal government is here to protect us in our property and in our persons. And that's why we have borders, and that's why we have territory and sovereignty. Those are all basics. Now, obviously, those basics much predate cyber attacks. But
right.
Isn't there some sort of federal responsibility to protect our, say, at the very least, our national institutions, but presumably also our big companies that are operating here, maybe our public utilities that are here, or just individual Americans? Are we just supposed to be exposed, notwithstanding claims of jurisdiction by the United States federal government?
I can tell you that companies are taking it upon themselves, as is the grid, the infrastructure, that these companies are taking upon themselves to protect their proprietary information that it is not hacked. I mean, they have very sophisticated people they hire to do that. I don't think we want the federal government to have access to all of private companies' IT information in order to conduct the necessary security for that kind of protection. I think we have to rely on companies to do that. But to answer your first question, an act of cybersecurity or a cyber terrorism, to me, would be what you alluded to, would be attack on the electrical infrastructure of the grid or some other public utility which would really cripple the economy of the United States, as opposed to making a threat or onto a specific company
Okay, for Mark, this is Dan Miller. For the sake of further argument, let's let that go. What retribution, what act of revenge or punishment, if any, do these hackers? What are they liable for? And in what sense should the U.S. government or Sony be the agents of putting that punishment on?
I doubt that Sony is going to be the only tool by which Sony would be able to exact punishment on these would be through the legal system, right? And I doubt that this is ever going to come up. The evidence of this is ever going to be such that Sony's going to be able to file a lawsuit.
How about the government?
Well, that's a different question. I mean, so the administration is going to have to make a determination as to what if this truly was, an act of invasion by the government of North Korea, and what proportional response should they exact upon them for that?
What felonies were committed that we currently know of?
Multiple. I mean, it's countless. It's just by accessing their system, stealing their information, extortion. It's endless. But I mean, the little guys who are sitting behind the computers around the world or in North Korea, but probably elsewhere as well, are never going to be able to. It'd be virtually impossible to trace who those, identify who those people are.
This is Charles Lipson. I want to agree with you in saying that this is a very complicated issue about letting the U.S. government protect these organizations, because if the NSA, let's say, already has information, there's a question about whether they should be able to share that. That's one thing. But if you want to sort of have a prophylactic practice where the U.S. government uses resources to try to protect these companies, that lets them inside of private systems to a degree that's very troubling.
Well,
to me,
and let's point out that Mike Rogers, chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, doped out a bill on this very subject, and it passed the United States House of Representatives in the last session of Congress. It died in the Senate over concerns such as those you mentioned.
Those need to be debated.
At the same time, Chris, and
John McCarran now,
my Republican friends at the table are sitting down, so I'm going to say something critical of Barack Obama without fear of injuring anybody. I was really taken back when he said, gee, I wish they had called me. This thing had been percolating for 3 weeks, and I'm thinking the White House hasn't been talking to Sony, or Sony hasn't been talking to the...
Well, and it turned out, of course, the CEO of Sony, within 45 minutes, recited the White House senior staffers with whom Sony had been in constant communication.
But did they get through to Valerie? That's the real question.
Are you being facetious?
So that was something.
No, I mean, if you really want to connect with the important figure.
But the other point I think is worth making is North Korea is kind of a crazy state, which there are a lot of crazy states out there, maybe not as crazy. But more importantly, the Seoul, Korea, is within cannon range of the border of North Korea. We have no basically conventional response to if North Korea opened hostilities on South Korea. I mean, it would immediately get totally out of hand.
Well, nobody's proposing a military
response. A lot of times I'm in discussions with pundits or even politicians who don't know a lot about the military, and they don't understand why North Korea is a special case.
I agree with Mark in saying, in effect, let's treat this the way that gated communities treat security. Inside the gated community, they have their own patrols. It's hard to get in. You want to do all that. But a gated community is still also protected by the police in Austin, Texas, or Orlando, or Chicago. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's the right way to look at it.
Well, I want to get to this issue of the federal government's responsibility, because of the networks in the United States, Mr. Fleshner, 15% are government or public or utilities, 85% are private. And is there not necessarily does that not call upon policymakers to come up with ways to create some kind of protection for the private networks without, piercing the veil of privacy and crossing the Fourth Amendment?
I'm not a IT guy or cybersecurity expert, but I don't see
how we would invite the government into companies' networks, private networks, without having the problem that Big Brother is now everywhere. I mean, part of it is, I mean, part of being in America is that we each, you know, protect our own here. I get the whole border thing, and I agree with you that, and obviously the government, the federal government would have to step in on that. But it seems to me would be very troublesome, both legally and constitutionally, to invite governments into companies to try to protect their cybersecurity.
Thus spoke Mark Flessner, a partner at Holland & Knight, a former federal prosecutor, first-time guest on Beyond the Beltway. Thank you, Attorney Flessner, for making time on your Sunday night to join us in this conversation. We hope to have you back on the program and in studio, okay?
Okay, thank you very much.
That's Mark Flessner.
Great
to have you on. I am Chris Roebling, sitting in for Bruce Dumont, joined tonight by John McCarron, Dan Miller, and Charles Lipson. Hugo Chaviano joined us for our first hour, and we're going to turn to you for your phone calls right after these words. Stay tuned.
This is Larry King at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Tonight we've got a special guest for you to meet. What do you like to do as a kid?
I like to play baseball. I like to watch television.
What was your favorite sports team?
Sports team growing up was the St. Louis Cardinals.
What was your favorite vacation?
I think the vacation we went to New York City to the World's Fair, see Yankee Stadium.
Who was your childhood hero?
Childhood hero, probably Hopalong Cassidy.
What was your biggest fear growing up?
The biggest fear probably was that I would irritate my father.
What's the silliest thing you've ever done?
Irritated my father.
Give the gift of Larry King this holiday season. Order your gift certificate now at museum.tv. That's museum.tv.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Beyond the Beltway. We've got some terrific news for inveterate listeners and viewers of the program, and that is that our panelist this evening, Dan Miller, is going to be sitting in for Bruce Dumont on the TV version of Beyond the Beltway for the next couple of months. Is that right, Dan?
For the next 8 weeks, I think, while Bruce is in Southern California visiting his family. Bruce will be doing the radio program live from Southern California. I will be taping the TV version here at the Museum of Broadcast Communications for broadcast beginning Sunday evening.
And that is broadcast in Chicago on WYCC, one of the public TV
channel 20
stations out here in Chicago. Where else do people see it?
It'll be on Comcast channel 100, along with several other programs, and that will be on a loop throughout the week. So it's not unusual for people to say, "Oh, I saw this on TV last night," and in fact, it was taped several days earlier.
And what are we looking forward to? Are we getting deep into the legendary Dan Miller Rolodex?
The program really, Chris, is going to be a one-stop shop for local government. It'll be focused, a lot of focus on the aldermanic elections coming up on February 24th, the mayoral election, and a little bit on the governor. But certainly the governor, just because of the enormous implications of the budget and so many other things. But we won't be doing the international galactic discussion that Beyond the Beltway will be handled on the radio part by Bruce.
John McCarron is wondering if you're going to do Benghazi.
Not on my program.
Not
on this one.
All right.
No, sorry.
John,
this
it sounds like that's still reserved for your program.
But, John, we will be doing a lot on infrastructure.
All right.
You know how important that is.
When you're talking about these local elections, especially because this is kind of Chicago-focused, there are a lot of very intense elections going on around the entire region.
Indeed. This is a municipal approach. This is not just a narrow point of view, just on aldermanic.
We'll be welcoming all the Chicago listeners into to the program, and they can call in, you know, and that sort of thing.
No call in, it's taped. Once again,
Charles Lipson, former chairman of the Department of Political Science at the University of Chicago. Channeling Henny Youngman. All right. Thank you very much for that. All right. So, Dan Miller, you start up when? When's your first program?
January 3rd.
January
on Sunday. which is right after the end of Downton Abbey's premiere. Just stay tuned. Go to Channel 20, WICC, and there we are.
And there you are. All right. Terrific, Dan. Congratulations, and I hope you have a great time. Are you ready for your close-up?
Of love. Yes, I am, Mr. Terrific. Les Zeznik, or whatever that was.
DeMille.
Mr. DeMille.
All right. So
on with the program,
we're going to get on with the program and take the spotlight off of Dan Miller. Our phone number, 800-723-8289, 800-723-8289. If you've got a particular gripe or a particular plaudit to state about how the president has responded to the Sony hacking or how the federal government is protecting us from international hacking, please give us a call. If you're a law professor somewhere and you know the definition of a cyber act of war, give us a call. We're looking for that, 800-723-8289. We'd love to hear from you. I think this is a moment at which the public is going to somewhat catch up with the policymakers. Here's what I mean by that. There have been hacks and there is a cyber war going on for years and years. The Chinese, the Russians, actually I worked with folks who were afflicted by a bunch of, I'm not making this up, Bulgarian coders who were attacking private interests in the United
States.
Those
are usually financial crimes, right? Purely
that
financial.
That was, but that's not what's going on when the Russians and the Chinese are going after the United States Department of Defense, the Iranians and others. John McCarran, are we ready for a complete public understanding of cyber warfare?
Well, I think the average person probably knows a little better now not to put anything in their email to someone, especially if you're sending it to a hackable organization that you don't want everybody to hear. Witness the Sony executives joking about what kind of movies President Obama might like. You know, is it Django Unchained, et cetera? They reel off the names of
racially tinged comments.
Yeah. And which, I don't know, maybe that had something to do with why he said the other day that I wish they had called. I don't know. But
you can see that this is actually very serious stuff.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm intrigued by the notion that China is involved. You know, China really plays, they're new to this, to the game of international brinksmanship, and they do a very rash things with their ships, with their planes, and it wouldn't surprise me at all if they abetted this hack. And to me, that puts the Fortune 500 in the United States in a tough situation, because now that they've outsourced so much of the production and jobs to China in order to save a few bucks, everyone blessed that. It was a bipartisan thing. What happens if it turns out that the government actually has to do something about the Chinese?
Do you see a role for the government as an agent of punishing this kind of activity?
I think they need to be involved, sure. I'm not as paranoid as some about government involvement in business. I've always thought public-private partnerships are the way to go.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about government involvement in punishing.
Look, if something isn't done to punish the people who hacked Sony, there other people are going to be hacking other companies.
It should not be
proportionate. There has to be some retribution.
It should not be proportionate. It should be disproportionate. That we don't want to provoke war. We shouldn't take military actions. But there's no reason why North Korea, which is a state sponsor of terrorism, indeed it made a terrorist threat associated with this, shouldn't be back on that list. What? There's no reason why the bank in Macau shouldn't be sanctioned again.
So how do
again.
We play hardball with China, then, if that's where this takes us? I mean, where does that leave?
I don't think
General
that you.
Electric?
I do not. Let me say something about China. First of all, I don't think that you want to make this into a public thing with China if you can avoid it. Secondly, China's foreign policy changed dramatically several years ago. Until then, China's position was, hold, bide your time. We're rising. We'll have more power in the future. Don't push it. Now they've revved up the nationalism. They're pushing very hard in the South China Sea. They're taking very aggressive nationalistic stances. And there has been a responsive nationalism in both Japan and in South Korea. This is a very explosive situation. We need to be very careful as we do it. But make no mistake, China has been a big bully in the region.
To answer your question, John McCarron, and Charles mentioned the bank in Macau, which is used by many of the elites in North Korea to access the international banking system. And we mentioned earlier outgoing House Intelligence Committee Chairman Mike Rogers, who was on one of the Sunday talk shows today, said his problem with the president's press conference this week was not that he had a press conference. See, he should have been announcing at that press conference what he had already done and what he would keep doing to the Korean elites. And so there is we have a national technical capability, essentially, to shut down their access to the international banking system.
That's happened several times, by the way, Chris, where he's made a speech that's actually harmed what he could do. When he initially made his speech about ISIS before we did anything, they were masked in very visible things. He should have announced, we just bombed, rather than we're going to bomb in a week or two. When he made his speech about Cuba, he did a moral equivalence statement that I found really disturbing. You know, we used to be an imperial nation, and they're a communist.
And you might see us as colonialists, you know, with great reason.
Good Lord, defend us, for heaven's sake.
John?
Well, everything's got to be brought back to a bash of Obama on Beyond the Beltway.
Exactly.
I mean,
right.
That's what it's about.
You've mastered it.
There we go.
Did I go too far? Too soon, John? Too soon? You're
still holding out hope for a successful president?
Do you remember bashing Bush, or is that all dropped out of central memory?
I don't think I was on the show all that much during the Bush era.
Ouch.
But I'm still,
it lives on the internet,
I mean,
you know.
The trouble with brinksmanship with China is that iPhone in your pocket, Charles, was made there. And
Okay, but do you think that we should, I don't know. I mean, this is an honest question. Should we be targeting members of the elite in North Korea? Because of this.
That's what I was arguing.
I guess it
comes I gave the
Macau Bank.
Another one, John, and this is serious. It comes from the Wall Street Journal. And what they said to do is put that movie on a thumb drive, attach it to balloons, and send it over North Korea. Don't laugh. That's all done. That's done regularly now with transistor radios. That's how the word gets out in North Korea in many cases. This is done by an agency that sends these things over on balloons. Do that. At least it's a way to say you're not going to, you, North Korea, are not going to stop the United States from seeing a movie, how dumb it is.
You agree something should be done.
Yeah. I'm not a fan of Seth Rogen or B movies. I think the movie was a stupid idea to make in the first place. But we can't have another. I agree with the president totally. We can't have another dictator telling us what we can and can't see in our media.
Well, in one sense it was a dictator, but in one sense it was Sony telling us. I mean, the dictator made the threat, but it was Sony that caved.
Oh, I'm not so sure that Sony caved. I mean, the way the movie business works, you know, the studios make these films, distributors get involved to distribute the films, and then the theaters have to show the films.
Right.
And only 50% of the ticket price goes back to the guys who made it.
Just imagine if the movie were shown in Old Orchard and there were an attack. It's not an attack against the movie house in Old Orchard. It could have destroyed and hurt.
Mitt Romney had the best suggestion, actually, where he said that essentially you put it out. You could either do it on the internet or DVDs, and ask people to make donations to Ebola charity.
There you go. That's Charles Lipson. I'm Chris Roebling, sitting in for Bruce Dumont. We're going to be back right after these words. Stay with us.
Everyone loves vacationing in Florida. So why not experience it as it was meant to be? Where turquoise Gulf waters meet tranquil island beaches. Feel the powder soft sand between your toes. Revel in a glorious island sunset. Shop the boutiques of a seaside village. Ride horseback along tranquil waters. This is Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Real, authentic Florida, where you can discover an intimate downtown and sip cappuccino at a sidewalk cafe. Catch fresh fish for dinner. even tour a working winery. Just minutes from all the rest Florida has to offer. Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Plan your visit online at BradentonGulfIslands.com. That's BradentonGulfIslands.com.
Good evening, everybody. Hope you're enjoying your last Sunday before Christmas. It's Chris Roebling sitting in for Bruce Dumont. We're delighted you have joined us at Beyond the Beltway. And we're talking about the Sony hack. Alan of Park Ridge, Illinois, listening to us on the Big 89 WLS. Your call, your question for the panel, please.
Yeah, hello, gentlemen. Sorry Bruce isn't there today, but nice panel. My question is, hypothetically, let's say the shoe is on the other foot here, and there's a despotic nation who has a film industry, who has a despotic leader who decides to turn the tables on us and provide a film for to anybody who where the profile is that they assassinate the American president or they send a convoy over here to do that.
Right.
How do you think we would react to that?
Well, we know how we would react because during the Bush administration, there were films out and actually plays, too, I believe, but certainly films about the assassination of the president. That's just free speech.
John
unless
has forgotten
it's a specific
all of that,
threat. Unless it's a specific threat. So, in other words, if you burn a cross on somebody's yard, that's a threat to that person, and that person takes it as a threat. Whereas if you're making a movie or you're stating something in very general terms, then it's not. And so it's just free speech.
Alan, a quick question, and then we'll bid you farewell. Quick question is, do you agree that we should do something to North Korea because of this attack?
I don't know how much our sanctions are delving. I mean, I don't know what more we could do that we're not doing already.
Okay.
Alan, I think Alan raises an interesting point, and it's a philosophical point. Other cultures that did not go through the Western experience and the Enlightenment and wind up with the Bill of Rights and the First Amendment, other cultures have a different idea of what you ought to do and what's proprietous and what's not. And I mean, what if someone at another studio out in LA said, gee, boys, look at all this free publicity. We're not as scared of that. Let's make a movie about Allah. Okay. Uh-huh. Then, I mean, what would happen then? Would
that be? We know what happens. That guy goes to jail.
Yeah. That guy is still in jail.
Well,
and that was a clip. That was a nothing, you know,
a nothing burger. But
well,
you're right.
But I mean, I hope that my point is at least understood. In that,
what is the point?
And that is, other cultures have a different attitude about what is can be said without blaspheming.
We're going to say thank you. Hold on one second. We're going to say thank you to Alan, and let's go over to Arlington Heights outside of Chicago. Charlotte is listening to us on WLS. Go ahead, Charlotte, your question right away, please.
Hi. Are we afraid of North Korea? They are.
We ought to be.
Military. They have a nuclear weapon, possibly long-range nuclear missiles, the ability to launch a satellite, in other words, a weapon into the atmosphere.
And so therefore we should do what?
Well, their leader is crazy. I don't know.
Okay.
But it's a good point. I would say
they're an irrational actor.
At this point,
with very
they're not a threat
weapons.
Directly to the United States except by sabotage, but they are a direct threat to the South Koreans, and in particular, they have over 40,000 conventional short-range missiles that could reach Seoul. Seoul is very near the border, and this is a serious problem.
Well, that's what she's saying. Yeah.
So does that mean that this is extortion, and we cannot overcome North Korea?
At this point, it's not clear whether they have a deliverable nuclear device. What has stopped us from doing anything more, even in the early 90s, when there was a real serious consideration in 1994 of going to war against North Korea. It was ultimately stopped by Jimmy Carter going in as a freelancer and striking a deal on their nuclear reactors. But the big price would be how much damage could be done to Seoul. This is not something you could stop with Iron Dome.
Well, let me say, I'm glad you mentioned that because it gives me an opportunity, and I hope John is sitting down, to say I was one of the Republicans who was very bitterly disappointed with the last 2 years of diplomacy towards North Korea of the Bush administration, at which time Condoleezza Rice took over the North Korea desk and said they're no longer a sponsor of state terrorism, when basically every intelligence organization in the world understood that they were still sponsors of state terrorism. And for reasons I still don't understand, Condoleezza Rice negotiated, or I'm sorry, she orchestrated a series of concessions from which we have seen no change in behavior. Now, what does that tell us about our proper posture towards North Korea?
Well, it certainly shows that there are limits to the way we can influence the behavior of other countries, just as we were talking about the folks in Havana in the last hour. It's not like the United States has strings we can pull here and there to make them do what we want. It's a very indirect influence.
Well, are we seeing something about concessions not leading to better international behavior?
The analogy to Cuba is perfect, John, because the problem with North Korea and the problem with Cuba is that the hardline policies didn't produce the outcomes we wanted. So people said, well, why not change the policy, see if that leads to anything better? I think you're right in saying that Condoleezza Rice taking off the sanctions against the bank and taking them off the terror list didn't lead to changes, but her argument would have been the same as President Obama's argument about Cuba, namely that the old policy hadn't worked either.
Dan Miller, was it time for us to still be tough on North Korea?
Certainly, yes, absolutely. They'll wither on the vine.
It's Dan Miller, Charles Lipson before that, and John McCarron before that. We also want to thank our other guests, Hugo Chaviano, who joined us in the first hour to talk about Cuba and developments there, Mark Flessner in the second hour to talk about cybersecurity. Beyond the Beltway is a Genebee production produced in association with WLS Radio. I also want to thank Colin Bobbitt, Dylan Klauke, and Dan Dorfman for helping get this program on the air tonight. Until next week, when Bruce DeMott's going to be back on the air, this is Chris Roebling substituting and wishing you a very good night and a warm holiday season from Chicago.
This is Larry King at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Tonight we've got a special guest for you to meet. What do you like to do as a kid?
I like to play baseball. I like to watch television.
What was your favorite sports team?
Sports team growing up was the St. Louis Cardinals.
What was your favorite vacation?
I think the vacation we went to New York City to the World's Fair. See Yankee Stadium.
Who was your childhood hero?
Childhood hero, probably Hopalong Cassidy.
What was your biggest fear growing up?
My biggest fear probably was that I would irritate my father.
What's the silliest thing you've ever done?
Irritated my father.
Give the gift of Larry King this holiday season. Order your gift certificate now.